case of Allen against Potter. Mr. Jackson.
May it please the court and counsel, my name is Donald Jackson and I am plaintiff, of course, for the appellant. The first issue that I'd like to address to this court is the restrictions on the complaints that were imposed on us by the lower court. First of all, in the lower court, as the courts know, as this court knows, we filed several revised complaints, amended complaints, primarily because the lower court felt that the final agency decision from the EEO office of the United States Postal Service were the proper documents to control the content of the complaint at the lower court. We argued that in accordance with this court's past decisions, both in Snellenbacher versus Baskins and Kirsting versus Walmart stores, that the real controlling document is the charge, the EEO charge filed by the employee, rather than the investigation undertaken by EEO, in this case the EEO Department of the United States Postal Service.
But isn't that, in effect, what the court allowed when it said not only limited to incidents set forth in the 98 and 2000 FADs, but also it adds, and to other incidents occurring and to other reasonably related incidents during that same period, which, if it refers to anything, must refer back to the charges.
But the problem is that part of the charges in this case included a hostile work environment claim by Mrs. Allen or Ms. Allen. And we were precluded from addressing that issue at all in the final complaint that was allowed by the court. And let me just say that this court has said before, I think it was in the Jenkins case, Jenkins versus Blue Cross Blue Shield, that charges should be liberally construed so that they will effectuate the purpose of Title VII, and also bearing in mind that the charges are generally drafted by laypersons who are trying to do what they can to recite or to record what's happened to them. In this case, in all of the charges she filed, she appended an affidavit that she drafted.
But she wasn't signaling very clearly that she was bringing a hostile work environment claim, for one thing. And we have also said that for the conciliation process to work the way it's supposed to and for other things, there's only so far an employer, even the U.S. Postal Service, has to go to decipher what's coming out of, you know, these lengthy affidavits and accounts of the event.
Well, in this case, had they conducted a proper investigation, they might have found that out. But even this case originally was set before an administrative law judge of EEO for the department, for the United States Postal Service. And that law judge in, I think, 1994, 1995, sent the case back to investigations because of the poor job they had done of investigating the complaints up to that point.
But that's history at this point. I mean, the judge says that this case at this stage of the game is about what was in the 98, the events surrounding and the complaints surrounding the 98 and the 2000 final agency decisions, FADs, whatever they are. And as compared to what you seem to want, which is a 25-year course of events complaint, it seems to me the judge is quite right to say for the process to go forward, you have to have some definition to it.
No, I think that's unfair, and I think it was unfair of the lower court to go back and talk about that history. We were talking about specific events from 1990 forward. What happened in this case, each time she filed a charge and then filed an amended charge, those were ultimately consolidated in the case, one of the cases before us, 14-28-92. But in each affidavit, what she would do is recite the events that had happened plus the new events. Part of the events she cited in her affidavit was that she was threatened by employees, she was shunned They refused to discuss with her the operation of the machinery. She was threatened by a supervisor who she thought was going to strike her. An employee repeatedly tried to instigate a fight with her because she had named that employee in one of her complaints about disparate treatment with respect to the assignment of overtime. I think that constitutes a hostile work environment. But we were not able.
Suppose you're right, and suppose somehow or another this hostile work environment claim is here. Looking at the specifics that you just mentioned and comparing them to the kinds of things this court has required before a hostile work environment claim can succeed, I think shows that the normal hostile work environment claim shows something either far more pervasive than the incidents mentioned, at least in your briefs and in these materials, or far more severe, or perhaps a combination of the two. And not that, you know, all workplaces aren't nice places to work, but hostile environment has to be a pretty awful place, actually.
Well, this was
an
awful
place.
Well, this is an awful place.
Well, you say that, but when you think of, you know, people being attacked, you know, things falling on their heads, and all kinds of things happen that we say isn't enough.
Well, I don't read the cases yet to require that the person be physically attacked before we're involved in a hostile work environment. I mean, when you've got a situation where employees have elected to shun an employee, to refuse to discuss, and remember that these people have to work in conjunction with each other, and if they refuse to discuss with this one employee who happens to be African American and the only one working this particular tour, that it will impact her ability to continue her job. Plus the fact she has to go into the workplace every night concerned about whether or not an employee is going to physically attack her and concerned about whether her supervisors are going
to
attack her.
I overstate this record a lot.
Well, Your Honor,
the record is what it is.
I apologize for that, but I didn't draft these charges, obviously. Had I drafted the charges, I would have been more specific, but I think she is described, and if we were given the opportunity to include it in the complaint and develop it in discovery, I think we would have what would be considered clear evidence of a hostile work environment, which I certainly believe is there in any event. But frankly, that once the judge did that, of course, that pretty much emasculated the complaint. But in any event, we feel that she should have been able, given the opportunity. In one of the charges, he said it was buried in the charge that she used the words hostile work environment. But I think if you couple the use of the words, although I don't find the cases that say that you have to use the magic words every time you allege something, but if you couple the words hostile work environment with what she describes happening to her, I think she said enough in the charge for it to institute an investigation by EEOC, which they did not do, but because they failed to investigate, it should not have limited her ability to include it in her complaint, and of course that's in fact what happened to her. The other thing that the issue I want to raise with the court, of course, is the final decision of the judge granting summary judgment. basically, there isn't any dispute that two of the four elements under the McDonald test have been met here. She is African American. She was adequately, there isn't any question about her ability or the adequacy of her performance. But what the judge also finds is that she found was that she didn't suffer an adverse job action, and secondly, the individuals that she used for comparatives were not in fact comparatives. I'd like to address that last point first. They in fact were comparatives. They worked at the same post office. They worked on the same tour. They worked for the same supervisor. They did the same jobs. They were LSM or letter sorting machine operators. The difference is when they started their tour. Some started an hour before other employees, but they were all two or three employees, and at some point during the tour, they in fact overlapped on those tours. So they would be working for the same supervisor at the same time. They may start differently and stop differently, but in essence, they were all comparatives as far as that concerns. I think this court has also said that when you talk about comparable, you're not talking about identical. And in this case, the only thing that's different is the question of when they, in fact, started the tour.
No, I mean, there are other things that are different. For example, which day did they want off, and how many, what was the anticipated mail volume for that day, and whether they submitted a formal request or whether they didn't, and whether it was for time off without pay or not. There are a lot of differences with respect to the particular events that she claims were discriminatory.
You know, and that's the second point I want to address in terms of the adverse job action. She's not so much complaining about the denial of, say, annual leave or incidental annual leave on a particular day. What she's complaining about is the difference in treatment cumulatively that's afforded to her versus the other employees. For example, when she wanted annual leave, mail volume was always the reason, and or staffing, or a combination of both. When this case was before EEO, the administrative law judge that I had mentioned before specifically sent it back to investigations to find out what exactly was the mail volume. In fact, there was a direct order, come up with the exact mail volume, tell me about staffing, and if you don't have documentation of that, then show cause why you don't have that documentation. I raised that issue before the court below, and the court, in essence, credited the unsupported testimony, or statements, testimony in their affidavit or in their depositions of the supervisors. They had no documentation whatsoever that that was the reason.
What did you do in discovery before the district court? What the EEO did is what it did, but in the district court you have discovery tools.
Oh yeah, we asked for that. We asked for the documentation. It doesn't exist. We asked for the documentation to show what the mail volume was on these particular days, but it doesn't exist.
But of course, the issue is the predicted mail volume. So actually, you'd want to know the mail volume from a year earlier times 1.03.
I agree with you that that's history, but had that history been followed at the time of the investigation of this charge, that would have been available not only to the post office to present to us, but also to us to discover during the discovery phase of this. But
well, you're using up your rebuttal time, by the way. I don't know if you want to save any of it. But
yes, I do. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Jackson. Mr. Bross.
May it please the court, counsel. My name is Jerry Bross. I'm an assistant U.S. attorney for the Central District of Illinois in Peoria, and I represent the United States Postal Service in this employment discrimination case. The decision of the district court to grant the defendant's motion for summary judgment should be affirmed. The plaintiff failed to establish a prima facie case of racial discrimination, failed to argue, and therefore waived, and also failed to produce any evidence regarding the claims of retaliation, and failed to present a valid claim for a hostile work environment. Before bringing her actions to the district court, the plaintiff relied on two EEO cases. One was a 1992 EEO case, the second one was in the year 2000. Both of those EEO actions defined the issues that were properly before the court. In the 1992, the first EEO action, the plaintiff asserted that on four occasions in 1991 and one time in 1992, she did not get the annual leave that she requested. I've submitted cases that pointed out that in my brief on page 41, and also Griffin versus Potter, that the denial of annual leave is not an adverse employment consequence when the demands of the employer require the presence of the employee. This is, I think, especially true. It's not an adverse employment consequence in the facts of this case, because in 1991 and in 1992, Linda Allen earned 208 hours of annual leave. In both of those years, she used over 206 hours of annual leave. So she got 5 weeks of annual leave. Now, it's true she didn't get the exact days on each and every time she demanded it. However, there's also a declaration in the record that says that no employee in the Postal Service gets to dictate to the management when they are going to get their annual leave. In fact, in 1992, which is, there was one time, it's an issue in this case, she was denied annual leave. It was only on one occasion she was told, no, you can't have that date. And she claimed employment discrimination. It's not an adverse employment action. There have been, I also want to point out that in three of the four allegations regarding the denial of annual leave in 1991, she claimed in her deposition that they were that those were based on retaliation. She was asked, are those discrimination or retaliation? She says retaliation. There was no argument made in the district court, and there's been no argument presented in this court as far as the elements of retaliation. There's no comparable with some other employee who had not engaged in protected activity. So not only did she not meet her burden, retaliation is waived.
You would agree, though, would you not, that failure to receive overtime payment is an adverse employment consequence if, you know, everything else falls into place?
Yes, there's a monetary impact in a failure to get overtime when it's earned or when it's appropriate is an adverse employment action. However, in this case, we have a lack of a burden of proof there. The overtime desired list, and the management was not always required to go to the overtime desired list, but when they went to the overtime desired list for overtime, they were required to take the person at the top of the list. The list was organized in order of seniority on a rotational basis so that the most senior person got the first overtime, the next opportunity rose up, and they rotated till the person went to the top of the overtime list again. In these instances, when she alleges that she was denied overtime, she fails to say that she was the next person on the list. Her argument is essentially, well, somebody on that overtime desired list was deserving of overtime, but there's no evidence in the record that she was the person next on the list. So she can't even show that there was an adverse employment consequence regarding her failure to get overtime, if one could say.
Is that list in the record, or does it exist?
The list did exist. I believe it's attached to Galleon's deposition in the record in 74, Exhibit G, I believe, or H.
So you think we'll find, if it's there, we'll.
I believe so.
Yeah.
I believe so. The list, though, is we described it in the record, if it's not there itself. It's comprised of 6 to 8 employees. It was changed every quarter. People could sign up or sign off the list. It had a minimum of 6, maximum of 8, and it, like I say, it rotated through. So there was one more step that the plaintiff had to show in showing an adverse employment consequence, and that was on December 13th, for example, or December 20th.
It's a question of adverse effect rather than of discrimination. If you say, I want overtime on day X, and you don't get it, that's adverse, but on your view, not discriminatory. We don't want to confuse no discrimination with no adverse employment effect.
You're right, Your Honor. I was referring to the fourth element of the McDonnell-Douglas test with race discrimination, which requires an adverse employment consequence. And that's what I meant by saying.
If you walk up to the postmaster and say, I want an extra $50,000, and he doesn't give it to you, that's surely adverse, but most likely not discriminatory.
Yes, Your Honor. As far as the the hostile work environment claim. The defendant filed a motion for partial dismissal of the second amended complaint because the plaintiff failed to exhaust her administrative remedies regarding the hostile work environment in either one of the two EEO complaints.
Now, her argument is that's because the administrative authority dropped the ball on the hostile work environment claim with respect, I think, to the 98 one.
Right.
I mean, the thing that culminated in the 98 decision that was actually the 92.
It was filed in 92, and it took a long time. The EEO judge did remand it back, said there's an incomplete investigation here.
So why isn't the problem here not that she failed to call it to the agency's attention, but whether on this record one could think that a rational trier of fact might find it a hostile work environment? I mean, this is summary judgment. Our review is de novo.
Yes, Your Honor. What happened was after they remanded the case back, the EEO asked the defendant, tell us, or the plaintiff rather, I'm sorry, Linda Allen, what are the issues involved here? What are you trying to tell us? What do you want us to investigate so we don't mess up again? She said, here's what I want you to investigate. And she wrote a letter, and the letter had the five denials of annual leave in 1992 and 1991. Nothing about hostile work environment. So even though it wasn't clear, and although it was a 13-page, single-spaced, rambling affidavit that someone could argue maybe buried in there is a hostile work environment claim, when it came back and when they said, show us, what are you talking about here? She said, it's just the five incidences. She was specific, as the district court found, and she listed the dates and the incidences in when she was denied annual leave. So there was a lack of notice that she was providing a hostile work environment claim. That concludes my remarks, unless there's any other questions.
Thank you, Mr. Gross.
Thank you.
Any further, Mr. Jackson?
I kind of find it strange that counsel claims that there was no evidence that Ms. Allen ever claimed that she was at the top of the list. Ms. Allen, in fact, as part of her complaint in this whole scheme of things, also complained that she was the only employee. Again, she's the only black employee that works on this tour and under these supervisors, that she was the only employee that was denied an opportunity to review the list to see where the rotation was at. But she pretty much always knew where she was supposed to be at on the list, and under the circumstances when she made complaints about whether or not the overtime was offered to her or not, it was legitimate charge as far as she was concerned. Part of the argument for this overtime was the after shift. This is one employee who was on every overtime list. Before shift, after shift, holidays, weekend work. And one of her complaints was that after shift overtime almost routinely was denied to her, while other employees before her, who started before her or after her, always got the overtime. And the complaint was that the supervisors never knew until 11. She got off at 11. All of a sudden at 11:15, they knew that there was going to be overtime called. Well, that's one supervisor. Other supervisors said that as part of the scheme of things, at that particular time of night when the processing is done, they knew or should have known by 6:30 that what the mail volume was going to be and therefore whether or not overtime was called. And the second thing they knew or should have known was that by 10:30 they should have known what it was and what whether or not overtime was called. But they have repeatedly denied her this overtime, and this is part of the pattern that we're talking about, the adverse pattern, whereas other employees within her group are routinely granted this overtime at night.
If you look at the total overtime hours per year of the plaintiffs and the other people who are on the overtime desired list, what do the numbers look like?
As I think I said in my brief, that her requests for overtime were almost denied. I can't remember the exact numbers, but more than the other employees.
How many hours did she work
overtime in a year compared with how many hours somebody else on the overtime desired list worked overtime in a year?
I don't know the answer to that.
That would be the way to make your point, would it not?
Well, I think the denial is the way to make my point as well.
But what if it's denial on day one, that if you look to the 365-day period, you know, you would say, oh, well, she worked, you know, 100 hours of overtime this year. I'm just picking a number out of the air, and somebody else worked 200 hours. Well, there you see that she was really coming out on the short end of the stick.
Sure.
If she worked 100 and the other people were all working around 100, it would look like things kind of smoothed out over a period of time.
The red light's on, but if I could just briefly respond to that. I don't know that you could discern that fact from the overtime, the total hours, because some overtime was forced. Everybody worked. So that would also be included in the total overtime hours, and whether or not you could break it out would be another issue. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you very much, counsel. The case is taken under advisement.